and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. We begin in France on a history-making weekend.
I'm Vicky Barker at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, about to reopen 5 years after the devastating fire. Some 250 firms and artisanal groups have worked to replicate as closely as possible the materials and skills used by the original medieval craftsmen here. The rebuilt golden rooster atop Notre Dame's iconic steeple has been reimagined as a phoenix, that mythical bird which is reborn in flames.
A ceremony will be held today. The cathedral officially opens to the public tomorrow. It's day four of a multi-state manhunt. CBS's Bradley Blackburn on the search for the suspect who gunned down the head of a healthcare insurance company.
New images overnight show a backpack found in Central Park that police believe may have been left there by the suspected gunman shortly after that brazen attack on United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. The manhunt for the gunman now spreads across multiple states. Police say they have more than 200 images of a person of interest and traced his movements after the shooting to a bus terminal where they think he left the city.
South Korean President Yoon survived an attempt to oust him. For now, our Remy Innocencio is in Seoul.
This is not the end, hardly. A top South Korean law firm we spoke to said that the legislature can still try to impeach the president if they just tweak some of the wording in the bill. Lawmakers say they are willing. They have a lot of support.
In Syria, opposition forces have taken control of key cities and are advancing towards Damascus. CBS's Sam Vinograd says while the group poses a threat to U.S. interests,
however, this opposition group and the United States to ultimately share one goal, which is for Bashar al-Assad to leave power.
83 years ago, the United States was plunged into World War II.
President Franklin Roosevelt.
December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
President Biden spoke at the White House last night about the war and his uncle Ambrose, who didn't make it back.
General MacArthur, who sent my family a condolence letter honoring my uncle's sacrifice. And the general wrote, he died serving in a crusade from which the better world will all come.
Michael Toscano, CBS News, Washington.
It's been nearly 6 years since her last race, and skier Lindsey Vonn is now working on her comeback. She's entered a series of races this weekend at Copper Mountain in Colorado. It could be the first step towards seeing her on the World Cup circuit once again. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Seth here, host of Over the Back Fence. We're on the air live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., taking your calls to buy or sell, talk local events, or whatever, only on WFHR.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. More than 500,000 Wisconsinites are unpaid family caregivers. They're the backbone of our long-term care system. And AARP says the state could be doing more to support them. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Family caregivers often go without vital support, even as they provide an estimated 538 million hours of care to loved ones each year, according to AARP data. The holidays can bring added stress to their already full plates, but Martin Hernandez with AARP Wisconsin says times like these are when important discussions should happen.
This is an opportunity to come together with family and friends and have those open and frank conversations that people should be having about caregiving, both in the situation they might be currently, but then also planning for the future.
It's estimated caregivers spend on average about $7,000 a year on related out-of-pocket expenses. He says AARP Wisconsin will ask state legislators to once again consider a tax credit for family caregivers of up to $500 in the next session. A bill in Congress for a larger federal tax credit for caregivers has sat in a U.S. House subcommittee for almost a year. Expanding the state's family medical leave law to include up to 14 weeks of paid leave is also needed, Hernandez says. Proponents also hope the state will prioritize the needs of caregivers and the state's aging population as they develop the next state budget, which could include adopting the Medicaid expansion. Wisconsin is one of 10 states that has not yet expanded its Medicaid program, which would extend eligibility to about 91,000 more residents. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Central Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Mostly sunny this afternoon. We'll see a high near 37. Southwest winds at about 15 to 20 with higher gusts. For tonight, still breezy, a low of 27. Sprinkles or flurries for Sunday with a high near 38. Monday, sprinkles and flurries, 39.
Currently 33 degrees.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time. We'll take a look back at the weekend, update you on the news, and get you into the holiday season as we prepare to travel to Seattle. Join us then.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus, a law review. Thank you for joining me in this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, talking about all things rule of law related, spending necessarily the entire first hour of our weekend broadcast talking about pardons, not only because of the controversy that has been prompted by the current president's decision to pardon his son, Hunter Biden, for the prosecutions and the convictions that he has suffered, both in the tax area and also the firearms area, and for other things that he may have done during recent years. Also prompted by reporting coming out of some sources in the White House that the president, or at least his staff, may be considering some blanket preemptive pardons for people who have not yet committed any crimes. And one of you texted me during the break about the extent to which those threats are real, supporting this notion that I've been advocating that the president not do this, not only because of the terrific, horrific precedent that it would send, but also because of the messaging to the American population that somehow all of these people have been engaged in criminal activity for which they need mercy and for which they need to be forgiven. Well, we know well from recent times that the threats of prosecution by the president and, yes, indeed, by presumably his incoming director of the FBI are real. We know, for example, that Donald Trump has described this criminal and civil cases against him as witch hunts. They've weaponized the justice system against him. He has threatened to prosecute Democrats, election workers, law enforcement officials, intelligence officials, reporters, journalists, former members of his own staff, as I indicated just a few moments ago, late in our first hour, Republicans who do not support him. For example, Liz Cheney, he said, should be prosecuted for what she has done to our country. The entire January 6th committee, he said, should be prosecuted for their lies and, frankly, for treason, he said. Vice President Kamala Harris, whom he recently defeated in the election, should be impeached and prosecuted, he said. He promised to appoint a special prosecutor to go after Joe Biden and his family, suggested that Mark Milley, the retired chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, deserves execution, has described Letitia James, the attorney general of New York, who won this $450 million judgment against him for business fraud, again, a civil matter, and the judge who presided over that, Justice Arthur Engoron, should be arrested and punished accordingly. All of that according to our incoming president. Again, among those whose names have been floated for preemptive pardons are Representative Liz Cheney, the former representative from Wyoming. Other people include, for example, Anthony Fauci, former top infectious disease expert. We know him well for the government, whose advice on COVID-19 made him a target of some far-right attacks out there. We already mentioned Jack Smith and his entire team. Here's another one, Adam Schiff. He's a senator-elect coming into the Senate from California, who was a lead prosecutor of Donald Trump in the first impeachment trial. There are a lot of people out there who may be on the list of the president, maybe even the FBI director's focus for future investigations and prosecutions. And so the threat undeniably is real. It is out there. It has been articulated by the president, arguably by Kash Patel as well. Even so, with that concern, that legitimate concern about what a future Trump administration may do to all of these people, each one of whom, Republicans and Democrats alike, across the political aisle, have engaged in the service to America in ways that is honorable and decent, true to their own conscience, true to the law, and to that point, have not engaged in any criminal conduct. Not appropriate to extend to them pardons, suggesting that somehow they have committed crimes. Many of them, I would anticipate, if the White House chooses to do this, would say no. I suspect Jack Smith would decline a pardon. He is a prosecutor throughout his entire career for the Department of Justice at The Hague, obviously back here at Maine Justice as a special counsel. This is someone who understands the rule of law. He's incredibly bright. He's incredibly focused. He understands the commission given to all government officials. He takes serious his oath of office, as have all of these other individuals inside and now outside government. None of them is a criminal, and none of them should be pardoned for crimes they did not commit. That's the continuing advocacy. The story plainly will continue in the weeks of the remaining administration now, and will certainly continue in the early weeks, months, and years of the Trump administration coming up beginning on January 20th. All of that taking place while our United States Supreme Court is also busy and active. We know that the Supreme Court in this, its 2024-2025 term that began on October 1, has already identified just under 50 cases, 5-0 cases, to entertain as a part of its review of lower courts, principally coming out of the appeals courts. It has already granted what's called certiorari to about 47 of those cases, including 10 coming out of the Fifth Circuit. Not surprisingly, the Supreme Court interested in taking a look at what the most conservative circuit in the country, the Fifth Circuit, has been doing recently. About 5 cases coming out of the Ninth Circuit, 2 coming out of the Seventh Circuit, where we here in Wisconsin, also Illinois and Indiana, are located. As a part of this process, now the Supreme Court is pursuing, undertaking what it normally does, which is to call the parties in, to appear in front of them, and to entertain with them what's called oral argument, opportunities presented by the litigants, typically through their own counsel, their own lawyers, to argue before the court the merits of their positions, and also plainly an opportunity for the justices to pepper them with questions about the merits and demerits of their positions. You can hear all of those arguments live when they are conducted, typically beginning at 9:00 Central Time. Those cases are scheduled by the Chief Justice, by the administrative officer of the Supreme Court. You can identify those. You can go online and you can listen to them. You can also listen to prior arguments that have been taped. Just this past week, 4 major oral arguments before the Supreme Court, before the entire panel of 9 justices, and 2 of them appropriately highlighted here on Amicus Law Review as a part of our continuing focus on the important work that the Supreme Court does, not only in defining who we are, what our country is all about, but in many ways, in recent terms, changing the very fabric of our Constitution. This past week, probably 2 cases that don't fall into that broad and dramatic category, but nonetheless are important for the future of agencies and for the future of civil rights in America. What are those 2 cases? Well, let's talk about the first of one of them. This is a vaping case. This is a case where the justices are faced with the question of whether or not the Food and Drug Administration, yes, that's a federal agency, acted lawfully in refusing to accept some applications from the makers of flavored liquids that are used in e-cigarettes. That's for vaping. These e-cigarettes have names like Jimmy the Juice Man Peachy Strawberry, Signature Series Mom's Pistachio, and Suicide Bunny Mother's Milk and Cookies. Now, the reason why those names are important are not because they're funny and they're sort of silly even to say out loud, but because of the suggestion that those names are attractive to young people. A 2009 law, it's called the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, mandates, it requires that new tobacco products, the producers of those, obtain authorization. They got to get the okay from the Food and Drug Administration to market, to produce those kinds of products. The manufacturer's applications under this 2009 law must demonstrate that their products are appropriate for the protection of the public health. And it's pursuant to that mandate, and again, invoking the names of these e-cigarettes, the vaping cigarettes, that the FDA has declined to grant authorization for these kinds of products, saying that they're especially attractive to youth, and for that reason, a significant portion of our public health would be compromised. Interestingly, the United States Court of Appeals, yes, here we go again, for the Fifth Circuit, ruled just in January that the agency changed the rules in the process of applications from these various companies and accused it of regulatory switcheroos, their words, not mine, and sending the companies on a wild goose chase to try to comply with what the FDA has done. The court said that the agency's actions were arbitrary and capricious without foundation. And so, just this past Monday, Supreme Court case, the name of it is Food and Drug Administration versus Wages and White Lion Investments. That case argued before the Supreme Court. Agency lawyers citing another appeals court that reached just the opposite conclusion from the Fifth Circuit and saying that the Fifth Circuit decision denying the capacity of the FDA to do this, to protect the health and the safety and security of a particular population, including especially youth who might otherwise be attracted to these flavored liquids that are used in e-cigarettes. The FDA is doing what it's supposed to do. And pursuant to that, nothing about this is in violation of the mandate given by the Congress to the FDA to act. The Fifth Circuit decision is an outlier, according to the lawyer for the agency. He said that common sense tells us that a flavor like mother's milk and cookies is going to be disproportionately attractive to children. Now, in fairness, the lawyer for the manufacturers said the agency is engaged in a bait and switch. He said, by saying that certain kinds of studies were not required and then rejecting the applications for failing to provide them. He said FDA never communicated that there is going to be an end-all, be-all litmus test whether there were comparative efficacy evidence presented. All of that language meaning he's upset about the process by which the FDA came to this result. But several justices during the course of the oral argument on Monday said that the 2009 law itself required a showing that the benefits of the products outweighed their costs. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, we frequently hear from her from the bench. She said this. She said the statute makes it the litmus test. You, she said, addressing the lawyer for the manufacturers, are trying to change the statute. But the statute, she said, is very clear. Tell us that your product is going to help adults stop smoking cigarettes and show us that youth is not going to start. In addition, Elena Kagan, another justice of the Supreme Court, said there was little question about that. The agency had determined that the flavored liquids, she said, were aimed at minors. She said everybody basically knows that flavors are particularly dangerous in terms of kids starting the use of smoking products. Blueberry vapes are very appealing to 16-year-olds and not to 40-year-olds. As we continue our discussion of this, we'll talk a little bit more about the argument before the Supreme Court on vaping that happened just this past Monday, why it's significant for the future, not only of the FDA, but also of health in America, as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids' home of Nightlight with Peach Schwabe.
Time to lace up those skates with 105.5 WIRI and your Wisconsin Rapids River Kings. Join us for every home game this season. Take the pride in your team like they do each other. As Coach Paul says,
you got to have everybody buying in, and you got to be playing for the logo.
Hear insights from Coach on Playmakers Mondays at 5:30 on WFHR, and join us for every home game on 105.5 WIRI. Support the boys of winter as they build hockey up and down the river. Game on!
The holidays are here, and it's nearly time to pick a present from our grown-up gift list with our Civic Media statewide text to win contest. Listen while you work for the keywords to text for your chance to win $100 cash, an overnight vacation at Chula Vista Resort, and be entered to win one of our grand prizes, a robot vacuum, new luggage, humidifier, espresso machine, and more on our grown-up gift list at civicmedia.us. Just download the Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 11, 1, and 4 for your chance to win starting Monday morning. You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
This is Amicus, a law review. Thank you once again for joining me as a part of our discussion. Right now, the United States Supreme Court, these major cases being undertaken and ultimately resolved probably not until May, June, maybe even July of 2025. But oral arguments right now on some major cases pending before them, including this vaping case. And as always, on these issues and others, very much inviting your comments and questions at 855-752-4842. Be a part of this conversation and encourage that dramatically here on Amicus, a law review, during the course of the oral argument on Monday. Once again, debate as is appropriate, as is routine, between the lawyer for the agency saying, no, this is things that we're doing are consistent with a mandate to protect children. Lawyers plainly for the manufacturers disagreeing. The attorney for the manufacturers said a lot of adults, he was addressing Elena Kagan, says a lot of adults use blueberry flavor and other non-tobacco flavors. Often the quitting journey, he said, quitting tobacco products, is to move away from tobacco or menthol flavors because they don't want to be reminded of the combustible cigarettes. Again, arguing that the FDA's action was not consistent with their mandate and saying that the products were appropriately on the market. The attorney again for the agency saying that vaping was safer than smoking, but nonetheless that the threat of future addiction or other concerns, health related concerns, by virtue of these particular flavored liquids being out there, outweighed any concerns about the FDA's concerns here. The attorney specifically saying that the fate of the case, of course, is in the hands of the Supreme Court right now, but also noting that this is one of those cases where a new administration could change the position of the FDA, could basically rescind the position. And for that reason, the position of the Department of Justice through the agency attorney could change in a new administration. Fascinating argument about the FDA and, of course, its authority, too. We know that the Supreme Court, again, continuing to look at a lot of cases involving the authority of our agencies to act by virtue of their authority given to them by the Congress. Delighted to have on our Amicus line John Peterson calling in to be a part of our conversation. John, glad to have you with us on our weekend discussion.
Yeah, it is great to be with you. You have so many great topics to talk about, including, you know, the FDA making the argument about the products added to these smoking products, basically, or vaping products. It's just the question I have in regards to that is when the new administration comes in and they put the people that they want in charge of those departments, will they be challenged in court? Will they have to prove the reason why they're doing what they're doing is within their purview of power, or are they exceeding their power? That's going to – it could hold them up as well. right?
Absolutely. And so, John, you have identified why it is, exactly why it is that when we elect a president, these things are so important. It's not just the policy. You and I know very well. You work tremendous, great work on behalf of civic media generally. You know well that when a president, get a new president, policies change. But yes, indeed, it also affects the ways in which our cases are presented. And by our cases, I mean those of the people of the United States are presented before the Supreme Court. As I just mentioned, and you followed up and provided some more detail about this, when the new administration comes in, it's entirely possible that an FDA could reverse its position and say, no, we're going to permit the manufacturers to go ahead with these e-cigarettes with these various youth-attractive names. Indeed, Donald Trump has said that he is going to save vaping. And that's a promise he has made. So we should anticipate, right, John, that will happen. What happens, right? What is the consequence of that? So what it means is that the FDA presumably would permit these products to go forward. And then, to your very good procedural and process point, then you could also get another lawsuit, someone challenging the new FDA and saying, wait a minute, you're not properly exercising your authorities. You're not protecting us from what you're doing here.
Exactly.
And you could get the issue back again before a lower court, before an appeals court. Maybe you, maybe others attacking then a new FDA for going in the opposite direction. And yes, indeed, John, to your very good point, it's in that setting that judges should once again say, all right, now that you're the petitioner asking for the overturning of an FDA position here, tell us more about, again, the reasons why the FDA is acting appropriately.
Exactly.
Right? Right?
Right. Exactly.
And again,
it's almost shocking, but you know, and you and I have talked about this before. It's the Chevron deference.
It is.
Overturning that has put everything in flux. Now we can't depend on anything from any administration, and why we voted for that particular president to put his administration in place. Now all those arguments are gone. All we're doing is just putting a president in place, and it doesn't matter what kind of administration he puts in power. They're all going to be challenged.
Absolutely. And again, the litigation, John, as you plainly indicated, that continues undeniably. And, you know, I think to the larger point you're making, John, as I think we've articulated this, but it deserves underscoring, which is when you elect a president, you quite literally also can change the law in America. When the Supreme Court makes a decision in this vaping case, it's got another case. Here's the other one that you and I have talked about. You've got that case involving Vanderstock versus Garland. That's the ghost guns case. Well, it seems as if the Supreme Court in October was very much in favor of deciding in favor of the ATF, right? And saying, yes, you can regulate ghost guns. Trump administration will almost certainly reverse that position, get rid of the rule, and the law then goes in the opposite direction. Now, again, you can challenge that, but it flips the arguments one side to the other, and it accomplishes a significant change in what the law is in America. Absolutely, John.
It's crazy.
Right.
All right.
Very good. John, I appreciate your call. We'll look forward to
fun talking to you.
Absolutely. Look forward to more of our conversation here on this show and yours as well, and looking forward to doing all of that down the road. John, thanks for calling in. We've got another caller calling in right now as well, and her name is Angela. Angela, thanks for calling in to our weekend broadcast.
Hi. I just have a question. Is there any way that Biden can, protect the people, not say a pardon, but say, help them out maybe with lawyers or something along that line for the people that are being asked about or talked about for retribution? Is there any way we can help them with a lawyer versus pardoning them?
Right. So that's the other piece of this. I think probably what you're talking about, Angela, is okay, if indeed the president follows the view that he should not do these preemptive pardons, and there are in fact investigations, those may still come. And Angela, to your very good point, many people have said, of course, that the investigation itself can be the punishment, right? Even if you don't end up with a prosecution, requiring that you respond to all sorts of things out there and documents, those kinds of things, that itself can impose a burden. And Angela, I'm going to answer your question in greater detail after this break, talking about the ways in which we can support those people who might be the targets of these investigations coming up. Appreciate very much the inquiry, and we'll follow up with you after this brief break.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
CBS News Brief. President-elect Trump is in Paris meeting with French President Macron as that nation formally reopens the Notre Dame Cathedral. CBS's Vicky Barker is there.
5 years after its devastating fire, Notre Dame Cathedral is reopening on time and under budget. But what a budget. $600 million to restore and renovate and replicate as much as possible the medieval originals.
Other insurance companies are worrying after the fatal shooting of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. CBS's Bradley Blackburn explains.
United Healthcare and other insurance companies are scrubbing information about their corporate leaders from websites, concerned about potential copycats.
It's curtains for Taylor Swift's Eras Tour after 20 months and five continents. Radio host Lamar Dawson.
This is a legendary show. It was huge for her and her fans. This definitely cemented her as an icon, as a legend.
CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keys.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks lose in Boston. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks kept it close. The game featured 11 ties, 14 lead changes, but Boston pulled away and got the win, 111-105. Doc Rivers pretty much summed it all up.
I thought we played great basketball for 3.5 quarters, and then I thought in the fourth quarter, the last 7 minutes, we went away from our execution that we were doing all game, a lot of tough shots. So, good learner for us. You know, the one thing when you watch them, they don't do that. They resist. Even in their ISOs, when they're covered, they put the ball on the floor to make plays for each other. I didn't think we did that tonight.
The Bucks are now 0-9 when they play in Boston. Men's college basketball today. Marquette hosting Wisconsin this afternoon in Milwaukee. The women's college volleyball tournament, the Badgers and Golden Eagles, are in the Sweet 16, headed to the regionals next week. Last night, the Badgers beat number 7th-ranked Georgia Tech at the Fieldhouse in Madison 3-1. Marquette held out in a thriller over Utah 3-2. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The excitement.
Oh, he stones Brodzinski with a glove save.
The energy.
What's he going to do? He shoots and he scores.
The tradition.
You've got to understand history if you're ever going to write.
Central Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Mostly sunny this afternoon. We'll see a high near 37. Southwest winds at about 15 to 20 with higher gusts. For tonight, still breezy. A low of 27. Sprinkles or flurries for Sunday with a high near 38. Monday, sprinkles and flurries, 39.
Right now, 35.
When the weather is cold, it's wonderful to warm up with freshly roasted coffee or a delicious tea like turmeric ginger. Family Natural Foods carries organic and Wisconsin roasted coffees and teas to delight your senses and warm you from the inside out. Find Wisconsin-based Wonder State, Liberation Farms, and Ruby Coffee roasted local and fresh. They also carry Reishi Tea, an independently owned Milwaukee company inspired by tradition. Warm up at Family Natural Foods.
El Cafe presents their Express Burritos. Stop and grab an Express Burrito in steak, chicken, beef, Tres Amigos, Zapata, Carnita, and Machaca. Express Burritos are a perfect solution for busy people who need a quick, nutritious meal. Whether you're headed to school or work, Express Burritos are an efficient way to stay fueled throughout your busy day. Stop by El Cafe today and grab your Express Burrito to go. Complete any meal with a slice of homemade pie.
Join our advertising family on WFHR and WIRI and see how radio can help improve awareness, revenue, and staffing for your business. I'm Ashley, and it's my mission to help our area businesses thrive. Call me today, 715-496-0710.
Join the conversation with your favorite hosts or shows anytime. Find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Share your thoughts on our social media channels wherever you are, whenever you want. The Civic Media Network of local radio stations here for you.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
We know what happened the last time Trump applied this ham-fisted tariff policy. He had to write a $12 billion check to farmers because he crushed so many of our agricultural exports and drove up the cost of single-family homes because the cost of lumber from places like Canada went way the frick up. Everything got more expensive.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we're in Washington, D.C. to talk about the Trump transition and how progressives need to reform their year-round campaign tactics.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow, weekday mornings starting at 6.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about a number of different issues in this, our weekend program, including pardons, including the Supreme Court, this vaping case that it had heard oral argument on just this past Monday. We're also going to talk about this transgender case, major case coming up for decision by the Supreme Court as well. Right before our break, Angela called in with a question about the president or others can do something to support those people who may not be accepting pardons because they didn't do anything wrong or not acknowledging any crimes, but nonetheless may indeed be on the receiving end of investigative pursuits, unfounded, unsupported by the law, in fact, but nonetheless pursued by a Justice Department led by Pam Bondi, led by Kash Patel over there at the FBI one day, encouraged by the president, who has identified many people who on his list who might indeed, from his view, be appropriate for prosecution. And once again, difficult to prosecute people through a grand jury process, but an investigation, absolutely. And as Angela was indicating, can we provide those people somehow with lawyers to ensure that their economic stability is not compromised, that they are not brought to their own knees, if you will, just by virtue of having to pay for lawyers and do all those other things that are burdensome, admittedly, during the course of a investigation, including testimony and providing information and documents, all kinds of things that could happen in an investigation? The answer is yes, of course. There are all kinds of things that can be done to support those kinds of people. Plainly, many of them do reach out in social media and other platforms and say, I need money to pay my lawyers. And depending upon your own perspective on the legitimacy of their situation, who they are, you may choose to support them. That is your right as an American citizen to offer to pay for some of, not all of, the legal services provided to them. There plainly are situations where other agencies will come forward also. We know them well out there, who do this kind of work out of their own sense of commission and purpose, who say, you know what, these people are being improperly investigated. It is significant, and we should respond in a way that ensures that they are not, in fact, brought to their knees, either economically or professionally or even personally, emotionally. Their family is not compromised by these kinds of inappropriate investigations. Those agencies, too, can do that sort of thing. And so there are imperfect and incomplete remedies, ways in which they can be supported. Most importantly, Angela, I would say, would be public notoriety, public discussion of what is going on if indeed a future Justice Department is used to be the retribution that Donald Trump has talked about. If your Justice Department under Pam Bondi, under 92 U.S. attorneys, under a Kash Patel at the FBI, decides to go after those kinds of people, and the names of them I provided in our previous segments, and others, we need to be vocal about that, right? We need to be out there saying, this is wrong. This is not what my government should be doing. This is not a proper use of the Department of Justice. And no, you're not responding to a weaponized witch hunt from which or that you were the focus of. That is simply not the factual premise for doing any of this. And so it's important also for the public to respond if indeed, post January 20th, there are individuals who have not committed crimes but are good public servants, regardless of their political affiliation, where they were, what they were doing, If you didn't commit a crime, you should not be the subject of a criminal investigation in our system. Angela, appreciate very much the comment and the observation about all of that. Speaking of things in our society generally, the other major Supreme Court case addressed by our High Court just this past week involves transgender care and our transgender population. This one has to do with transgender youth in particular. It seemed that on Wednesday, in a case that raises for the first time issues of transgender rights, and in particular, once again, youth, the medical care that can and cannot be provided to them in their transition process, seemed like members of the Supreme Court, at least a majority of them, seemed ready to uphold a Tennessee law and the laws of other states out there, maybe as many as 20 of them, that would deny transition care to transgender youth. And the issue, of course, comes up because there are about 20 states, including Tennessee and others out there, that have prohibited medical providers from prescribing puberty-delaying medication, providing hormone therapy, performing surgery to treat what those laws call, and this is a quote from the legislation itself, purported discomfort or distress from a discordance between the minor's sex and asserted identity. That kind of law, again, attempting to restrict medical doctors, families, youth, again, all with parental consent, from pursuing those kinds of things that medical doctors would recommend and provide and offer to families and to youth who are facing the body dysphoria and the other concerns that have prompted a lot of the appropriate look at our transgender population. Families and doctors, three families and a doctor, sued to challenge the law in Tennessee. And the Biden administration has intervened on their side. The challengers said the law violated the Constitution by denying equal protection to transgender people, primarily by discriminating against them based upon sex. And of course, the Tennessee lawyers, the Solicitor General there, disagrees. He says, no, this is not sex discrimination. Interestingly, we've got lots of comments from the Supreme Court justices themselves in both directions. The burdens of the law fall equally on boys and girls because neither can transition. Those comments seemingly made by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, supported somewhat by Amy Coney Barrett, who herself was asking some good and appropriate questions about the medical aspects and the legal aspects of all of this. Some conservative justices also seemed inclined to follow the court's approach in overturning Roe v. Wade 2022. You recall that well. Majority there said regulating abortion is a matter for the states. And Justice Kavanaugh, for example, says gender transition care is one of those things. He said the Constitution doesn't take sides on how to resolve the medical and policy debate. He said the Constitution is neutral on the question and therefore joins with the Chief Justice, who said the Constitution leaves that question, that is, whether or not the states can restrict medical care for transgender youth, to the people's representatives rather than to nine people, none of whom is a doctor. He's talking, of course, about the Supreme Court. On the other side of this aisle, of course, you've got members of the Supreme Court who are pushing back and saying that, yes, indeed, this is sex discrimination. Yes, indeed, this is violation of equal protection. And for that reason, the laws should be overturned. Elena Kagan said there's another way of looking at the law like this, maybe a more obvious one. And she says it sets a classification based on transgender status. Among the factors the court has used to determine whether to grant protective status to groups warranting some heightened scrutiny, which is what this is all about, are whether their traits are immutable and whether they have political power. And Elena Kagan basically is saying that, yes, indeed, this is that kind of strict scrutiny that should be applied here, and therefore these laws should be found unconstitutional. Interestingly, silent during the course of this oral argument was Neil Gorsuch. Neil Gorsuch was the author, you may recall, a number of years ago of this case involving Bostock. It was an employment discrimination case, but basically said that the word sex, when it comes to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, applies broadly. It includes people of all sexual orientations and gender identity and transgender status as well. And so if the word sex, as it's set forth in that legislation, is that broad and requires protection under the law, then the result should be, if you invoke that same principle, that there should be protection. There should be constitutional protection, statutory protection for people who are seeking transgender medical care, including, especially here, people of a young age. Clear, once again, under the law that all of these folks, that none of the youth are going ahead with this without parental consent. Many people arguing that this case should be argued as a parental consent issue. That indeed, in many cases, we let parents decide how their children should be medically treated. Why not here? And that also plainly a part of the public debate, even beyond the debate in front of the Supreme Court. Lots and lots of debate going on again this past Wednesday when it came to understanding whether or not the Tennessee law and laws in other places should be supported. That Bostock case, again, concerning the Equal Protection Clause, which is also at issue here. The reason why this case is before the Supreme Court is because last year a three-judge panel of the Sixth Circuit, a divided judge panel there in Cincinnati and Ohio, upheld Tennessee's law, saying that was a reasonable legislative response to contested medical evidence. That's what the lower court said. The question now before the Supreme Court is whether or not that Sixth Circuit decision that applies, yes, indeed, to Tennessee, but to other states as well, whether the thinking of the lower court makes sense, whether or not that should be supported or overturned. It appeared that there may well be a slight majority, maybe a majority of Supreme Court justices who will find that this should go back to the states and that it's a state's matter, as they found in 2020 with respect to abortion and Roe versus Wade being overturned in Dobbs. They may say, send this back. This is a thing that the legislatures can do. It's not for us to decide. Plainly, a lot of pushback on that particular issue, not only because of the precedent set here, but as others have said, why not trust the parents here? Particularly in a situation where there's not the kind of direct harm to third parties out there that you might see in other contexts. That was the position argued by our outstanding Solicitor General, who was there again on behalf of the Department of Justice and behalf of the government generally. Once again, this is one of those cases where, depending upon what the new Trump administration may say, that position articulated by our Solicitor General may change wholesale, may go in the opposite 180-degree direction, and there may be, at least on one portion of this case, a very dramatic reversal in the way in which the government is arguing this case before the Supreme Court, which could also affect the result ultimately coming out probably in May or June. The case is a very important case, not only for transgender rights, for youth rights, but also for civil rights generally. The Supreme Court continues to address these kinds of matters involving privacy, involving civil rights and human rights. Note as well that another transgender set of cases under Title IX, that's the civil statute that mandates certain inclusion in academics for people of immutable characteristics, including sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, transgender rights. The question is whether or not transgender rights and transgender positions are also protected under Title IX in an academic setting, as opposed to this medical setting. This issue may also percolate up even during this term, maybe among the remaining 10, 15, 20 cases yet to be decided by the Supreme Court in this term. Transgender issues, a major matter now pending before our United States Supreme Court. Anticipate again that along with the vaping case, along with these other matters that we have discussed, sometime in May, June, maybe even July, Supreme Court telling us what the Constitution says, what sex means in terms of the umbrella coverage that it should indeed provide to people of all sexual orientations and gender identities, including those of transgender status. We'll continue to monitor all that and discuss that as Amicus Law Review continues, not only today, but in the future broadcasts here on Civic Media. We know as well that this past week saw some other news, significant news. I've mentioned it already in a number of other contexts, and that is the decision by the incoming president to nominate Kash Patel to run the FBI, presumably taking over 2 years before the present director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, completes his 10-year term. I'm going to talk about Kash Patel in somewhat greater detail down the road, but note as well that Kash Patel, a hardline critic of the very agency that he would be leading, has called for shutting down that agency. And several years ago, he indicated that he would bring that agency and others to heel, H-E-E-L. We'll talk a little bit more about Kash Patel and then some final thoughts about what happened in South Korea this past week that are also lessons for all of us, including a future administration here in the United States of America. All of that here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for the Todd Allball Show.
Guess what, Mrs. C?
What, Santa?
We are ready. The Santa room is finally open. Oh, boy. The Santa Claus has really set it up nice this year. What do you think, Mrs. C?
Oh, it's so warm and cozy and welcoming.
What do you think, Mr. Jangles?
It's better than your old room.
All the kids and the families can come now and they can take free pictures with Santa.
Bring your own camera, cell phone. Take as many pictures as you like.
And it's all free.
Yes.
Well, how do they find out about us?
Go to our Facebook page, Santa Central Wisconsin.
And they can book a time to come see us?
Yes, definitely. And pets, too.
I think the cookies are really good.
Now, we only have so many cookies and you can't eat them all.
Too late.
Mr. Jingle.
I'll have to make some more then.
Our head elf, we need to retire him.
I'm already retired.
Oh, okay. Make sure you come check with us, set up a time, and come and see us.
We're ready. Santa Central Wisconsin.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
This is Amicus Law Review in our final segment this weekend, talking about two issues, one briefly, one a lesson for all of us, the briefer issue, which we will revisit in future broadcasts, and that is the stated intention by the president-elect to nominate Kash Patel to be the director of the FBI, this major federal agency, again, inside the Department of Justice. It is not an independent agency responding to the Attorney General, Kash Patel. We know a number of things about him. He served in a series of administrative positions near the end of the first Trump administration. He was on the National Security Council, some posts there, also at the Pentagon. Before leaving office in early 2021, Trump floated the idea of making Patel the deputy director of the CIA or the FBI. And significantly, Bill Barr, you recall he was the attorney general at the time, wrote in his memoir that Mr. Patel would have become deputy FBI director over my dead body. And again, lots of people now pulling up things that the presumptive nominee has said about not only the FBI. He has talked about it being the source of a lot of problems in terms of law enforcement America. And beyond that, we know some things about Mr. Patel's own history. He has spoken about his own qualifications for the job. He said that he has tried over 60 trials. Colleagues from Patel's time as an entry-level public defender in Florida. Again, it is good, important work to be in a defensive posture there. And in federal cases, as I've spoken at great length in the past, we require defense attorneys to be a part of this process to ensure that the process goes forward well. Many people in Florida are calling me as being sort of a C-plus, a middling performer there with a deep animosity toward the Justice Department and, again, an agency that he may at some point once again be a part of. And Mr. Patel spent about 3 years as well as a terrorism prosecutor at the Justice Department itself. Again, the federal public defender on the one side, also a terrorism prosecutor. He's repeatedly claimed that he was the lead prosecutor in the government's pursuit of the perpetrators of the 2012 attack on that U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya. Remember that event involving the death of four Americans? You may recall well that at the time, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, a lot of criticism of her and others for that attack. He maintains, that is, Kash Patel maintains, that he was the lead prosecutor. In fact, that's simply not the case. He was a junior Justice Department staff member at the time, was not a part of that trial team. Many other things involving his authoring of a memorandum called the Nunes Memorandum that officially places him in the attention of Donald Trump. He was arguing that the investigation, the Russia investigation, was unsupported, that being undertaken by the special counsel at that time, Bob Mueller. Lots of things about Kash Patel to know, and we'll be talking more about him in future broadcasts here on Amicus Law Review. It is important, as we did in connection with looking at Pam Bondi, to understand who this person is presently, what their plans are, and what their past has been, because it's a best predictor about their future conduct in what is, once again, a tremendously important position inside law enforcement of the United States of America. Finally, as I promised, some commentary about what happened in South Korea this past Tuesday. You recall well that early in the day on Tuesday, President Yoon Suk-yeol of South Korea imposed martial law in that country. A democratic republic, obviously South Korea has had a history, a very colored and checkered and remembered history involving the imposition of martial law since a military dictatorship ended in the country in the late 1980s. People remember that well. The president this past Tuesday imposing martial law, again, principally because of the admittedly politically unstable situation there. A huge amount of controversy between him and opposition figures there in South Korea. He maintains, the president does, that he cannot get his job done, cannot do the things that he wants to do as a part of his mission in that position as the chief executive. Nonetheless, not the basis for imposing martial law in a nation, wildly overstepping his authority, wildly doing something that not only do people in his own party recognize as inappropriate, but plainly members of the legislature there, the National Congress there, responds very quickly. They respond almost immediately by rescinding what he has done, a 190-0 National Assembly vote to rescind the decision on martial law, and plainly affecting a very swift rebuke of Yoon's response to his political crisis. And hours later, Yoon himself convened his cabinet, which approved once again the reversal of the martial law imposition. The point of all of this is what happened among the citizens of South Korea. When they heard about this, almost immediately, what did they do? They took to the streets. They went out into the streets and they said, this is not what our government is all about. We are not going to take this kind of inappropriate, admittedly in the middle of a political crisis, but not a national crisis requiring the imposition of martial law. We're not going to stand for this. They took to the streets. They assembled around the National Assembly to prevent law enforcement from going in to stop the National Assembly from voting on this. Citizens ensured that members of the National Assembly could vote to rescind martial law. They stood arm in arm against the police, chanting, end martial law, end martial law. Others filled a section of an 8-lane road to call for the arrest of the president. There were protests in downtown Seoul after a trade union with more than a million members declared an indefinite general strike to demand the president's resignation. People took to the streets there and said, this is not our nation. This is not the Democratic Republic that we know. We are not going to tolerate it, and we are going to require, mandate, that our government behave toward us and toward the basic trappings of government in the way that a democratic republic should. And indeed, it is the people, it is the citizenry, yes, in concert with their elected representatives who also were horrified by what the president has done, but the people who came forward and said, this is not us. And that is the great lesson, not only for the people in South Korea, the power that the people have to ensure that their government does not do kinds of things that are plainly contrary, not only their best interests, but are completely inconsistent with the rule of law, the basic things given to an executive to do in the exercise of his or her power, but also sending the message about the power given to all people on the face of the planet, including us here in America. As we look forward to a future administration, the power of the people to change those things that are not acceptable and to pursue those things not only in courts, but also in the other avenues open to us as citizens of our amazing, wonderful nation. This has been Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Join us every single weekend as we talk about these and other issues in the area.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, he is featured in an article in the Cap Times, and he's the host of Nightlight. Across Civic Media, Pete Schwabba will be joining us. And, of course, this shouldn't be a thing. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Since 1992, DoorWorks Incorporated has been providing, installing, and servicing residential, commercial, and industrial doors and openers throughout Wisconsin. They're located right here in Wisconsin Rapids, and they're fully licensed and insured. All of their employees are certified, trained technicians that are trained to install and service all types of doors and openers. DoorWorks Incorporated wants to wish you and your family a very safe and happy holiday season.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.